From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Groundsman Conversations. Today's episode is brought to you in partnership with Web3 Sports Ventures. They are on a mission to create fan-first, data-enabled digital strategies that accelerate innovation in the games that you know and love. To explore how Gen Z and Gen Alpha are engaging with sport, search Web3 Sports Ventures on LinkedIn. We have a terrific guest joining us shortly, but before we introduce a terrific guest, I've got two very average human beings join me as the third average human being. The first of them is the pirate captain himself, Charles Morgan. Hello, matey. How are you?
Hey, Grant. I'm very well. I've actually, for this guest, I'm actually lying on a couch and I'm ready to go.
Yes, perhaps if you could put some clothes on and put the grapes away, Giles, it would be even better. But we'll let our guest worry about that when she joins us. I'm sure she'll have a field day analysing you. And the third groundsman, of course, we couldn't do it without him, Roger Mitchell. Hello, Roger, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm changed. I'm a changed man, actually, after having read Dana's book, which we're going to talk about now. But this is a new Roger Mitchell. I'm a gentler soul.
Good God.
Well, I tell you what. Let's give it some time for the book to sink in, shall we? Before we make claims like that, Rog, because I would suggest you probably need to read volumes 7 through 15 before you're a changed man. But hey, you live and learn. Stranger things have happened. Well, listen, this episode is brought to you by our friends at Web3 Sports Ventures, and I am thrilled to let you know who is going to be joining us shortly. And but to do that, I'm going to allow the great man himself, Roger Mitchell, to introduce our guest.
Well, it's Dr. Dana Sinclair, a licensed psychologist who has spent a career working with top performers in sport, business, and indeed medicine. And I really can't say any more than recommend the book that we're going to discuss, which is Dialed In, Do Your Best When It Matters Most. I think you're going to be thrilled by the conversation, guys.
I mean, it's hard to think of a better tagline for the Entertained Old podcast series, is it? Dialed In, eh? That's us. Well, let's not waste any time, and let's welcome Dana to the show.
Dr. Dana Sinclair, thank you so much for joining the Groundsman. Are you not entertained? Thank you for finding the time.
I'm looking forward to the conversation for sure.
Listen, I'm going to give everybody, all the listeners, a little bit of an introduction to you. You correct me if I'm wrong here, but I don't think I am. You're a licensed psychologist that has spent a huge amount of your career working with high performers in sport, in medicine, in business. And, you know, I ran into your book 2 or 3 months ago and I have devoured it. I was caught by all the testimonials on the back page. Can I just read one if your modesty allows me to, Dana?
That would be very nice if you did it, yes.
This is from Kyle Lowry, who Grant, you'll know, is an NBA point guard.
I know exactly who Kyle Lowry is.
Okay. Dr. Sinclair is one of the world's greatest people, first and foremost. That makes her talent and knowledge for helping athletes get the best out of themselves more extraordinary. She's down to earth, she's relatable, and she will always be one of my favourite people. Thank you for being so great. And of course, then you read the book and it's just full of these kind of examples of you finding a way to help these extraordinary people who in some way or another have got some challenges with their performance, with their ability to unblock what's maybe getting in their way. And I just wanted to bring you on to speak to Giles and Grant and tell us a little bit about what this reality is, because, you know, my own view is that it's becoming more and more a major issue in sport and in general and in life. Some people say mental health, maybe it's mental distraction. It's certainly a harder world these days with your whole life seemingly available to be criticised on social media from one second to another. So, you know, I wanted to bring you on and just have a general chat without any kind of like Q&A session and just hear it from the expert. I'll pass you over to Grant now because I know he's got a million questions, but that would be the setup for today's interview, if that's okay, Dana.
It sounds great. And just to remember, everybody's a performer. Everybody wants results. Everybody wants to be good at what they do. It's just not easy to get that out of ourselves in the pressure moment. So it doesn't have to be that there's a problem or an issue. It could just be, hey, I want to be able to be better in these kind of moments where I get a little tight. That's all it has to be able to use this stuff.
Yeah, it's fascinating, Daniel. I come to this podcast and this world of sport purely as a fan. My life of 40 years now has been in finance, and I've done a bunch of interviews with people over the last 10 years, hundreds of them, in fact, all tangentially related to finance. But I have to say, some of the most interesting conversations I've had have been with people from the world of sport, because relating the idea of performance in sport to the idea of relating to the performance in business, in trading, in investing. To your point, in what you just said there so eloquently, it's everybody has this desire to perform in whatever it is they do. And I'm struck with how many common threads there are that you can pick out in terms of what enables great performance, no matter what it is you do. So perhaps to start, I'd love you to give us just a sense of some of those real core threads that string through every single profession, every single person, every single situation, because I find that utterly fascinating.
Well, ultimately, it is all about being able to shift your focus onto what you're doing in the moment. So I talk to a lot of people, of course, my clients, they are talking about the pressure moments, not during the day, their daily this, that, at work, at home. It's when they really want to do well or need to do well, or the moment is meaningful. Those are the times that I am working with clients. And working with, whether it's CEOs or IndyCar drivers or business executives. In fact, I do work for banks and work for wealth managers. And it's all the same process to get to your best when it's a little more difficult, because we've all got those pressure moments.
As I've watched great sportsmen, and the two to me that spring to mind always, and I love thinking about them in this context, are Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan, two guys who dominated their sports for a decade plus, which is extraordinary in this day and age. But what you said there is it, because they have those God-given otherworldly talents that other people at their very best don't have. But generally speaking, when you listen to them talk about their great success, it's always, they talk about this, the will. It's always the will. It's something mental. They have this ability to channel their mind into bringing the talent out of them. And it's never, I hit this great shot, I sunk this great putt. It's always, I knew what I had to do and I went back to my routine. I went back into my head and I managed to do something. And I'm hoping you're going to tell me what the hell that is enables you to do that.
Absolutely. And those guys in particular, like talent, obviously they're super talented, but talent isn't what ensures success. It's the mindset and the approach. If your mind is cluttered and unclear, you're not going to be able to do it when the pressure is there. So those two in particular, they were able, naturally or half learned, maybe, they were able to shift their focus when they needed to, and they could keep doing it no matter what the situation was. So they could get their tension down enough and be calmer, clearer, and able to stick on what to do. Whereas a lot of people get overwhelmed by the moment and rely on how they feel, and they get distracted and derailed by how they feel instead of being able to stick on what they need to do. That is the biggest secret to performing successfully.
How do you, sorry, Roger, I'm going to hog this. Just for one more follow-up, Dana, because this stuff is just, I love this stuff. So can you help people understand maybe some of the simple things that allow you to do that? Maybe not to that level, sure. Mm-hmm. but some of the simple exercises to go through when you're in that moment where you can feel the pressure.
Yep.
How do we as mere mortals deal with that effectively?
Well, we as mere mortals have to do it ourselves. So there is a process that I have learned with my clients over decades that actually works best. And it's simple and it's applied and practical. But there's three steps first step, most important, you have to figure out what gets in your way, what frustrates you, what derails you, what are your hot spots. Those are the big things. And there's a whole list. And, you know, there's sort of the big five, but everybody, if I showed you a list of people's derailers, hotspots, the first one would be results. Oh, I'm thinking about stats in my ranking, winning, losing. Everybody has to tick that off because that's the biggest derailer out there. As soon as we shift our focus from what we're doing, it usually goes to, oh no, how am I going to do? Am I doing all right? But the whole list could be, you know, 20 things long. Expectations, negative self-talk, self-doubt, self-criticism, the weather. It could be anything, but you have to figure out what your super derailers are. And everybody's got one or two that, oh, if I just don't have to worry about that, I'm great. But when that pops into my head, I'm in trouble. And then I need to shift on over to, you know, there's a few skills that you have to pre-plan.
Dana, let me introduce the third groundsman, Giles Morgan.
Giles
is the smooth, sophisticated military man of the three. And
that's why I put on a suit for you. I just had to play the part. Dana, it's a great pleasure to meet you. And I thought I'd just pile in straight away. I know that Roger and Grant have been answering and already fascinating. I've been listening. One of the great privileges of my role currently running sponsorship for big organizations around the world is using athletes, former athletes, current athletes, to be the spokesperson of the organization and to represent the companies that I work for to the public or to guests or clients. And one of the things I've really noticed, and it's always surprised me, is obviously most top athletes have a killer instinct. They have a competitiveness about them that means that they can absolutely win and put the foot down when it's required. But I'm also absolutely flabbergasted by how mellow, away from the track, away from the field, away from competition, they very often are, almost as a way of preserving the energy required for performance. Is there anything in that? That's just 30 years of observing very top athletes who, but if you played Monopoly with them, they'd want to kill you.
Well, there are very good observation. There are two types of competitiveness that I see. One is, I want to kill you. I don't want to lose. I can't lose at cards or anything. But then there's another kind of competitiveness. I just want to win. I want to beat you. I want to do it. There's a difference between not wanting to lose and wanting to win. And you know, it's surprising how many professional athletes are actually cautious, risk-adverse people. I've done thousands of assessments in all the top leagues, and it still astounds me that there aren't that many natural killers out there. They're very good, and over time they can get there. But in terms of the pure killers, they're hard to find. You have to sort of help them and bolster them to get to where they are.
Dana, I want to mention this book here, Dialed In, Do Your Best When It Matters Most, because frankly, you can't put it down because it's full of these examples, you know, and you go through all the examples of various athletes, and it's mainly athletes, but there's also surgeons and business people as well, but let's just focus on sport, where, you know, they can be 17-year-old, they can be a lot older, they can be already established and having a moment of doubt, they can be the opposite. And you talk about all these things here, that it's not really often what it seems. The confident ones can be the ones that are the ones that are most vulnerable. The people that have got fear, if you unlock that and take that away, they can become absolutely dominant. You know, in many ways, it's counterintuitive, your book and your experience. Tell us a little bit about what it's like with all these examples of, you know, scratching the surface and maybe finding something that's not what you expect.
Not what you expect. Well, we'll talk about red flags in a moment, but let's talk about confidence. I'd love to hear what you three think too, in terms of the performers that you deal with. Everybody seems to me to talk about confidence and how important it is. I can't be successful without it. That person has more of it than me. I'm in trouble. so interesting for me over all these years is that I have learned that, well, confidence is great. Yes, it's nice if it's there, helps you relax and whatnot, but you don't need it. You might want it, but you don't need it. It is overrated. And I talk to all my clients about this and they, you know, they fuss and worry about, I can't do it because I don't have confidence when they've just done it for, you know, a season and they're falling back again on their confidence and how they feel. Okay. So, you know, confidence, it's intangible. It's unreliable. What do you guys think? I mean, that's what I see, but you see different things perhaps.
Sorry, Dana, I'm going to come in again and I, yes. I apologize for monopolizing this, but this stuff is just so fascinating to me on such a deep level. And you know, what you said there, and just kind of to share my personal experience, because I've unwittingly and unknowingly dealt with this exact issue. You know, everybody has a level of confidence in them and what they do. And over the last 10 years, I've been on this journey from a completely private person to a semi-public person. And I now have in my tiny, tiny, tiny little corner of the world in social media, a what people, I think, believe call a presence.
120,000 followers, Dana. 120,000.
I've been on that journey
I'm impressed.
Well, don't be. Really. And hopefully
I have
we can,
three.
But well, listen, at the end of the show, you'll have at least six. So that's, I can tell you, you're going to double your count.
Thank you.
But I've been on that journey of putting myself through my work out there, and I've gone through the confidence cycle and been worried about what people think and worried about, and I've thankfully and very gratefully gone through that to the point where I now, it's not that I don't care, because I care deeply, but I realize that the only way for me to get over that is to just say, right, I'm just going to be and write authentically. It's just going to be taking everybody else out of this. What I write is going to come from in here, and it's going to be written for me and not for an audience or not for a person. And I'm just going to say, this is what I think, and this is my best attempts at getting that across to other people. And as long as I can do that, as long as I know when I hit send, I've done the best job I can do, and I'm happy with it, it's out there. And I won't say that I don't get prickly, not in a bad way, but in a sad way when there's negative feedback. I welcome it, but I hate it, you know, but it's useful. And you don't get too over your skis when you get nice feedback. It's very positive. It's lovely to get, but you don't believe when people go, oh my God, this is just wonderful. And that's the best I've managed to do, is just go, right, I'm just going to try and block everything else out and say, this is me, this is what I think, do with it what you will.
Brilliant, because what you've done just there is you did make a decision as to what you were, you know, what your goal was, but then you were able to shift from how you were feeling and the expectations and the worries, the feelings, onto what to do. And you kept focus on what you were writing and what your desires were in terms of the output and the results. So you did the process, you shifted when you drifted onto the good stuff, which is getting away from feelings and onto what to do. I've got many athletes that have had to do this, but I'm thinking actually of an American Idol contestant, singing shows like Britain's Got Talent. And she was in front of the judges, got through the first audition. I thought she was going to be so happy. She called and she was really, I mean, emotionally freaking out. I can't do it. I have no confidence. This isn't going to, it's not going to happen for me. I managed to slow her down and say, well, how did you just do it? If you didn't have any confidence, you just did it. What did you do? Oh, well, I do have a really good voice. And I was able to think about staying on top of my high notes during the audition. Oh, okay. Nice shift. So again, you don't need it. You might want it. And again, I should just mention that confidence isn't necessarily the answer either. Because again, I'm thinking of a top pitcher in Major League Baseball. And, you know, for for one season, he rolled through the regular season, strike everywhere, you know, award winner, et cetera, gets to the playoffs. Ooh, he's tight. He's not hitting his targets anymore. Oh, no playoffs. Okay. Well, next year, he thinks, no problem. I've got this. Same thing. Didn't take into account that he got tense and that maybe things shifted. Two seasons in a row, I got this. Couldn't get through the first playoff round. Finally, we talked about it because he was ready. And all that was happening is he didn't have an antidote to the tension. He really wanted the World Series. He really wanted playoffs. He didn't have to think about it during the regular season. But when his desires shifted and he really wanted something, it was meaningful. Of course, he got a little bit tense, but he didn't know how to manage it. He hadn't thought about it since he was a nervous rookie, and he just plowed ahead, and it was a problem. And so until he figured out, oh, I have to go technical here, get my tension down so I can just finish the pitch, extend out a little bit more in front, then I'll hit my targets. Boom. Then he was good, off to the races. So again, expectations, hot spots, derailers, feelings, all of those things get in the way of actual doing what you need to do in the moment.
Dana,
execution.
Dana, I have a question. You work with lots of different individuals and they'll all be different. Everybody is, I guess. Maybe they're not all different, but you probably can clump them. But
You can clump them.
But it seems to me that in all walks of life, this word confidence is often masqueraded by people's inner demons, inner fears. And masquerade is a great word in terms of people putting up something in front of them that makes the opposition or the inner demons go away. In your huge experience, I can think of some sports people who seemingly just have something about them mentally, that they have confidence or they have self-belief, perhaps more than confidence. This is something that is entirely abnormal. And even when they perform badly, they perform well. Is that a true thing or is everybody masquerading? Are we all hiding behind masks?
Not all. I mean, there is a lot of faux confidence out there that people, you know, fake it till you make it, which isn't a bad idea. But again, the naturally confident people, few and far between. But it's something that, again, I don't like people to worry too much about because it really all comes down to settling yourself down so you can get to what you need to do to actually be that fantastic performer. And it's got far less to do with your personality traits or your performance style than one thinks. Yes, a certain style will give you a more, you can get to your best quickly or more easily, but everybody can learn how to do it. So a lot of people masquerade.
Dana, let me come back a little bit to masquerades, people putting on a version of themselves that perhaps isn't the winning one. You talk a great deal in this book about red flags. And, you know, one of the hardest things in the sports industry and the team building industry now in general is making sure that the chemistry is there. There's no bad apples. There's no people that can upset the dressing room. Tell us a little bit about how you see these people early on. What red flags do you see?
Right. Okay. That's the one thing in terms of putting your performance culture together. The biggest detriment to your culture and to a franchise's being profitable and keeping their fan base is avoiding these red flag types. When I'm doing an assessment for a team or an organization, I am definitely looking to help them avoid red flags because they might be very talented or a rainmaker, but they are toxic in their behavior. And eventually, over time, they do cause trouble and things break down around them. And it costs organizations money for sure. You must have seen many of these.
Well, we're living that in the football industry in Europe, much more, I would say, than America, but let's say it's the same everywhere, but we can see so many teams in this side of the pond, big teams, brand teams, most normal fans would say, why do you have this person in your dressing room? They are one of the, but they continue to do it. Dana. They continue to do it. I don't understand when buying and recruiting players and coaches is such a costly exercise one way or the other, why they don't employ people like you much, much, much more. What is your experience about that?
Okay, it's a huge, to me, having an idea of what you're buying in a character, in of a person, it's a huge part of the risk management analysis. And if you're spending all this money on people that you cannot rely on the field, I don't understand it either, actually. Because, you know, in character, really, it's just a measure of a person's ability to act in a self-disciplined, you know, way. It's the, you know, character's the horsepower that drives your daily decisions. And if those are all over the place and unreliable and constantly getting somebody in trouble, we've got a monetary issue here as well as a performance culture issue.
Dana, I don't know if you saw, talking of this issue of character, I don't know if you've seen the Apple documentary about the New England Patriots dynasty. It's a fabulous sports documentary. And some of them, we've had a spate of these over the last few years, and some of them have been terrific and some of them have been kind of average. This is terrific. And they have all the leading players in there. And they talk, there's a whole episode, an hour long, talking about the Aaron Hernandez situation. And you know, Rog, you and Giles might not know this story, but Aaron Hernandez was a recruit into the Patriots, a rookie. The same year, Ron Gronkowski, who you might have heard of, came into the team. And the Patriots were at that point where they'd been dominant, they'd lost players, they were going down, and they had to try and pick the team up again and keep the dynasty going. And this kid, Aaron Hernandez, and they talk about it in the show, there were red flags about this guy, about his character, but he was too good a talent to not draft. And so they drafted this kid. Anyone hasn't watched the documentary, watch it. But he ended up committing suicide in prison after being arrested for murder and charged with the death of a friend of his. And all the red flags in his character came out afterwards. But Dana, Just that story, this idea of character and the idea of being strong enough as an owner, as a coach, as a manager, to say no to a talent that can take you to the promised land, but there are character flaws. Clearly, the Patriots ignored those and said, we can deal with it. It turned out horribly for them, but is there a way to ignore those? It feels to me like there isn't, but is there a way to manage character flaws and insert people with talent into a team?
Well, first of all, in my experience, you know, is anybody too good a talent to take that risk? If it's a full-on red flag, in my experience, it says no, that there's too much risk and you're going to pay for it. Now, the problem is people do fall in love with talent. I mean, I've been in draft rooms where scouts are fighting and trying to fight me on whether or not this person's a red flag. And, you know, I'm just trying to tell you what the personality is likely to do over a long season or a long career. And, you know, these sort of toxic individuals, they might, you know, fool you with some bouts of good behavior, but they invariably revert back to something that costs you time and money. So, again, red flags, people are starting to avoid them, certainly in North American sport, mostly because of experience. But say the people that I've worked for, owners and GMs over time, they get to a point where they say, okay, if it's a red flag, we're not doing it. Because they've done it before and it's destroyed the culture.
Dana, I have a slightly different question, but it's related to these individuals. When you have practiced, particularly in the world of sport, we're obviously a sports business podcast, so I'm going to focus on there a bit. You will see people often talk about the individual sports like tennis and golf, and people who say they're perfectly set up, they're so individualistic as people that they absolutely understand they can focus nothing else other than themselves and their own performance, but they'd never cope in a team sport environment. And then vice versa, those who thrive in team, but might not individual. is that sort of a load of rubbish, really? Is that just media conjecture? And actually,
I think it is a load of rubbish. Well, you know, people say individuals, they say tennis, oh, I could never play in a team. They've been doing it for so long. They've got only those skills. Of course, they're not going to be able to see themselves in a team setting. And often those people don't want anybody on the team interfering with them anyway. Vice versa, you get a team environment and you've got some of these super talented people that they've got all these sort of other grinders getting in the way. So it's like six of one, half dozen of the other.
Dana, the perfect example of this is the Ryder Cup. You know, we have these 24 individual athletes that spend their entire lives fighting to beat each other. And, you know, somehow, and I'd love to understand this better, but somehow every Ryder Cup, not every Ryder Cup, but 90% of the Ryder Cups, the European team, which is under-talented compared to the US team, seem to come together as a team, and the US team with all the talent in the world seem to find kind of new ways to flame out when they should win. Is that the nature of that difference? Is it, I don't see it as an inability to meld as a team, because you see these guys in chatting with each other and they seem to be good friendly rivals until they get on the course. Or is it individual stress as part of a team, and I need to perform for the team? I'm fascinated if you have any insights on what that difference is.
Well, I certainly have an opinion. I feel that the consistent individual delivery of high performance is the way to bolster your team, to do the best for the team. I think a lot of times people talk about, oh, you've got to be unselfish. It's all about the team. It's all about the team. Well, I think it's individual up rather than team down. If I'm doing great as an individual, handling the pressures, getting to my talent, it's great for me, but it's also brilliant for the team. I need to be able to individually get to my best. So I'm a big component part of, I love it to talk about the individual delivery, really, whether it's business or sport, that's it. In fact, I was watching Six Nations rugby, and one of the best players in the world, French fellow, and he actually said, you know, when I start to get tired or when I lose my intensity or my focus, I start doing things that are not good for the team. So when his individual performance is suffering because he's not focused, I mean, it's not that he's too tired, he's just not focused, that is detrimental for the team. So I like everybody to focus in on them as an individual. It's not being selfish. It's taking care of your own backyard and getting your skills, fulfilling your role on the team.
Yeah. Dana, on that, you know, you and I have exchanged some stuff around expectations and motivation. And I've just got this, we've got this kind of like gag that goes through the show about one particular golfer that we don't need to mention, that I believe that his major issues are in his head. When he is the probably the top golfer talent wise in the world, but we don't need to make it about him. What I'm asking you is, in this world of today where you are being judged in real time by everybody and their dog on social media, is it not really hard to keep your mental health about you these days? You know, you've got all your techniques that this book goes through beautifully, and it really is recommended for all of us. But, you know, I've got a lot of sympathy for, you know, there's two young tennis players, female tennis players in recent years that came onto the scene, bang, and then they went off the scene almost as quickly. And it just seems to me that it was a reaction to what I'm getting at here, which is I just think the expectations are so, so high now.
I agree completely, and I also have empathy. But isn't it interesting? The expectations are one of those huge derailers or hotspots that I talk about. And again, people get caught up in all of that. I have to do it perfectly. I have to do it even better. Well, no, you don't. And we do forget that, you know, trying to perform with success, like, it takes courage to try to be good, especially in front of the world. But again, people have to learn to be able to settle, make a decision that they're going to learn to perform with calm or with focus and set about doing that. And it's all about, you're going to get yanked into that distracted zone or that expectation zone, whatever the problem is. But you have to spend time figuring out how you're going to shift on back. Otherwise, it's impossible.
Dana, my mind is spinning with questions. This is the best interview because it just covers the whole of the whole sporting kind of universe. One of the things I'm particularly intrigued about is the sense of, we have it particularly in Europe, I guess, but all over the world is national pride, nationalism, playing for your country, the pressure of playing for your country, and for some athletes that takes them to a whole new level of performance, and for other they seem to underperform. But from a psychological point of view, and this could even be about playing for the very top club or franchise, but what is that pressure associated when you're playing for something that is so big in heritage that for a mere mortal, you're suddenly sort of shoved into a really, really emotive place? Does that have profound effects on people? It must do.
It certainly can. And again, we all come with our own performance style. And for some, it's easier to manage those ups and downs and those stresses, while others have to really pay attention and try to work at it. You know, because we've all got those certain psychological barriers that get in the way with that kind of pressure. I mean, you know, fans, my goodness, we love fans, but that fandom and rooting behavior, it's entertainment. So people don't see the individual person and the harm it can do. I don't think, anyway. So ask me more.
Well, Grant mentioned the Ryder Cup in particular, where you're not even playing for a very established, you know, they play for Europe, which doesn't really, I mean, I know Europe exists as a continent of which the British have decided to remove themselves from, playing in ghastly colours of blue and yellow, which does not work as a colour palette. And yet,
and you're listening to Fashion Talk with Charles Morgan.
And I have never, I think, other than the Ryder Cup, ever watched grown human beings of a certain demographic walk down the street in blue and yellow in a sense of pride, like they might with Manchester United colours or something else. And yet, something happens. There's some magic dust that happens that a team that exists from a continent that I don't think really exists in any other walk of life. I can't think of anything else that performs as Europe, not at the top level, comes together and everybody plays like a person possessed. And I find it glorious because it reveals something. And I did history way back when, and the whole sense of people fighting for their feudal lord and fighting for their badge, it seems to be something that is very deep set in human psyche. Is that fair?
I think that's very fair. And, you know, when you are playing in a situation like that, it is often, for many people, easier to take the pressure off oneself and put it on, you know, on the team, on the country. And it helps release some pressure for many people. For others, it's more difficult. But, you know, again, being able to manage whatever you find pressurizing you is the key to this. And again, you can look at it as a huge issue. Oh my gosh, I'm playing for the country. Or you can settle and get down to your job.
Yeah.
Sounds easy, I know, but there is a process.
Dana, can I take us back 20 minutes or so? Because when you were telling us the story about the major league pitcher, you threw two words in almost as a throwaway that were kind of lost in the story, which are these two: I'm ready. You talked about this guy, the pitcher, being ready. And I understand this, and some of the work I've done personally, you can't do until you're ready. You have to be ready for it. You know, someone could sit with you for hours and hours, and if they're not ready, it's time wasted. And if they are ready, it's the best time they'll ever spend in their lives. So how do people know when they're ready? And how do you know when people are ready. Because with, unless you know that, either of you, it's wasted time.
That is true. And you can get a sense of the resistance that you're facing, say, with a client, with me. Now, usually when they're sitting down with me, it's because they want something, to be better at something. And I end up being the one who pushes. So I will push if I can see a bit of a crack. They want it, but they are feeling vulnerable. So I will roll it out and see if they'll come with me. And if they won't, that's fine. We just wait and circle back around until they decide that they can handle it or it's really not going very well and they do need the help.
Is that it? When you say they can handle it, is that the telltale? Is that when you can hear hard stuff or hear difficult things and actually be constructive about them? Is that the telltale sign?
Well, that's definitely one of them. But again, they're coming to me, whether I'm on the sidelines during an NFL game or in a training room talking to someone, they're coming to me. So it's my job, it's incumbent upon me to gently push a little to see how far, you know, where the holes are and what's going to actually allow them to feel safe or have something that they can use from me. So really, I have to help people sometimes 5 minutes, 15 minutes, again, on the sidelines or before a game in a dugout because they're struggling or they're circling around wanting to talk to you. I need to be able to help them very quickly. Otherwise, I don't have a job. Who wants to sit there and talk to half an hour about, you know, the science behind cognitive behavioral therapy or performance skills? Nobody. Not my clients. They want it now. Skip the junk and get, you better help me now. Otherwise I'm out of here.
I love this, Dana. Listen, just before I forget it, you know, Jamie in your book, Jamie, that's me.
Oh yes.
That's me.
Jamie. Okay. I know you well, Jamie.
Yeah. Don't tell them. They have to buy the book to find out, but that is me. No, listen, the serious point, because everything that's coming out in the second half of your book, which is great, is about the fact that you can learn this. You can work with a process and, you know, in other ways of talking about this, it would be something like called nature or nurture. And your book, I guess, is in the nurture camp. Would that be a fair description?
Yes. Now, absolutely. I love people to check in on their nature, because then most of the things in their nature are just fine, thank you very much, but they might have one little spot that gets in the way. Know what makes you good. Know what puts you sideways. Fix the thing that gets in the way. There we go to nurture and the process. Don't worry about all the other good stuff. You're doing great. Just pick on the things, the one or two things that you know will make you better in the moment.
You know, I just on that, I saw one said Djokovic, Novak Djokovic talking. It was in an interview, and the interviewer said, "You know, of course, your great talent is your mental strength in the hard moments." And he said, "What do you mean? You don't think I work at that all the time?" And he talked about his breathing. And then I read your book, and it's so much about breathing in the right moment. And you know, talk about that a little bit, about some of the things that are the tips that are in the book. You know, there's obviously four or five chapters on each one, but some of them are just so, so interesting, Dana.
Well, I'm glad. Now, it's funny. I saw that interview with Djokovic too, and I loved it because he stopped that interviewer in his tracks. No, that's not a natural skill. I had to work really hard on that. And this is, you know, best guy ever, basically. And he's saying he had to work on his mental skills and look at what he's done with himself. So yes, the breathing. If you're going to, there's four skills I talk about. If you're going to pick just one, because you don't have to do all four if you don't want, you know, make yourself comfortable. Just pick one. It's got to be the breathing. It's being able to get calm and soothe yourself in the moment, or just a little bit calmer so that you can think. That's why I don't want people to go zen and really practice their meditation unless they want to, but it's about calming yourself enough so that you can actually, oh, what am I doing again? Hey, okay, I know I shouldn't be yelling and screaming, or I shouldn't be going into that position. I've got to get back to my job. So that's the first skill. Second one is performance cues, being able to pick out what are the one or two things that I know if I do, I'm going to execute, I'm going to play well, I'm going to play properly. And again, people think, oh, I shouldn't have to think out there. Well, I'm saying be prepared to think out there. So again, if it's tennis, you know, I had one young tennis player who you might have been mentioning earlier, Roger, and as long as she felt she could stay in her legs and stay in her legs to hit her shot, she was great. So when she was really good, that's what she did. That's a performance cue. Yeah, she won the U.S. Open. Good on her, because she was able to calm down and get to those one or two things that allowed her to put the ball where she wanted it to. Every job, every sport has different execution moments, and they're different for all of us. And I won't tell people what Jamie's cues were at this point. Okay? The other skills are, you know, you have to be able to talk your way through your performance. You don't just warm up and say, okay, it's going to happen. That's pretty risky. That's leaving it to chance. You better be able to manage yourself when you get nervous, tight, make a mistake, get frustrated. You better be able to talk your way through it. So it goes through sort of the self-talk that is useful and knowing your facts, knowing what makes you good. And then the last one is daydreaming. We all daydream anyway. It's imagery, visualization, but focus your daydreaming. 5 seconds here, 10 seconds there, 30 seconds of daydreaming a day, if it's focused properly, can actually make a difference to your skill set or your interactions.
Well, this is wonderful news for our producer James, who spends 7 hours a day daydreaming. This is great news for him. He will be delighted to hear this. Dana, listen, we could talk to you all day, but our hour has run out, and I'm so pleased that we got the chance to do this, and it is as perfect an advert for the book as I can imagine, because you've given us so much and yet left so much in the book on the table for people to explore for themselves, and I hope everybody that listens to this podcast actually goes and does that, because, you know, I'm not finished with the book yet, but I will finish it, and I've been on this journey myself, and I found it absolutely fascinating. It's a marvelous work, and I commend you on it. And for anybody listening that wants to find out more about the book and about you, just we'll do it anyway, but can you let them know the best place to do that? Because it's always better coming from you rather than us picking a couple of places and saying, hey, go here.
Well, certainly. I mean, just go to drdanasinclair.com or Instagram at Dr. Dana Sinclair, and you can find it all there.
Fantastic. Dr. Dana Sinclair, thank you from the three of us. It's been a wonderful conversation, and hopefully we can get you to come back on at a later date and continue the conversation, because there's so much more to talk about.
I would absolutely love to. Love the questions. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Well, fellas, I have to say, what a terrific conversation. I've had a few conversations of that nature through my finance career, and every single one of them has landed with me, and every single one of them is huge, enjoyable, and that was no exception. What a thrill. Well done, Rog, for persuading Dana to come and join us. I loved every second of that.
Yeah, me too. And I do recommend the book. She will join us in Como, where I think she's going to be a great addition to everything that we're doing. And I want to thank Wade and the guys at Web3 Sports Ventures for allowing us to do that.
Terrific. Well, listen, our thanks to our guest, Dana Sinclair. Please, please do go and buy her book. Our thanks to our friends at Web3 Sports Ventures, of course. And our thanks, as always, to you, above all else, for being out there and listening to us. We'll be back with another show in the not too distant future. In the meantime, if you don't follow us, you can do that very easily on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainR, that's the word A-R-E. You can find me at TTMYGH.
And you can find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
And myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lakes. Gentlemen, until next time.
Cheers, guys.
Wonderful.